This is Chris Albert, and I'm here to remind you of one thing. Someday, you're going to die. Now, that's not some morbid statement or scary idea. It's solid fact. Your time here on this earth is limited. And you need to be reminded of this as much as possible for one simple reason. To live your best life while you can. This is the Warrior Soul Podcast.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Warrior Soul Podcast. This is Chris Albert, and this podcast is where we deliver tools, tactics, ideas, and interview people who are here to help the U.S. military veteran community to live their best lives. Why do we do this? Well, over the last decade and a half, we've heard about the rate of veteran suicide. We've heard about veteran homelessness. We've heard about the high rates of chronic disease in the veteran community. We've had a lot of people out there trying to raise awareness, and that's awesome. But we're done with awareness. What we're doing here is we're taking action. Our aim is to give you actionable advice that you could take advantage of right after this podcast. We don't charge for it. We don't ask for a penny for any of this. All we ask is that you spread the word, that you let people know about the show, that you share an episode that could help somebody out with a person in need. Today, we have an amazing guest for you. His name is Mr. Steve Sims. And Steve is a high-end concierge. Now, what is that? Well, Steve's a guy who gets things done. And he gets them done for very, very rich people who don't carry a very high profile, right? We're talking about the super rich. People who wouldn't think twice about spending hundreds of thousands of dollars just for a good night out. And so Steve's arranged some crazy things. One example is he arranged a dinner at the foot of the Statue of David. He had the whole museum shut down. And while a couple was eating dinner there, he arranged for Andrea Bocelli to come out and serenade them. Now, they didn't ask for Andrea Bocelli, but Steve, like he always does, over-delivered. And what you're going to get from Steve today is an understanding of how he gets people on board with getting these things done. Because if you go to the Academia in Rome, which is the museum where the Statue of David is located, and you say, hey, I've got this amount of money and I want to get the museum shut down for the night, they're probably going to just slam the door in your face because it's not about money for them. It's about status. So what Steve does is he's a master at getting people on board. Same thing with Andrea Bocelli. If you just go up to him and you say, hey, Andrea, I got a whole bunch of money here for you. I just want you to come out and sing. He'll probably hang up the phone on you. Again, it's because of status. And Steve is able to make these crazy dreamlike experiences come true for people who can afford them. The other thing about Steve is this. He didn't grow up in a place where he was surrounded with rich people or anything like that. He grew up as a bricklayer's son in the east side of London. Very, very blue collar. And he really had to build himself up into what he is today. And we're going to get into his story. We're going to get into exactly how he gets these things done. And he's a really interesting, colorful character. He's not the kind of guy who rolls around in a suit. He's the kind of guy you're going to see in a black t-shirt, jeans, riding a motorcycle and drinking whiskey. So before we get into that interview, I just have a quick announcement from our sponsors, F-Bomb Nutrition. They make absolutely delicious packets of nut butters and other fats. And they come in these really awesome portable packets, but these things are absolutely delicious. I can't get enough of them. The nut butters have a macadamia nut butter base, and they're mixed up with chocolate, mixed up with sea salt, mixed up with pecan butter. And the company is run by really amazing people. They're sending boxes of this stuff overseas to troops on the front lines so that they can supplement their MREs with some good nutrition. And Again, I can't say enough about this company. If you want to try F-bombs out, you head over to www.dropanfbomb.com. Use the code WarriorSoul at checkout, and you'll get yourself 20% off of your first order. Definitely try these out, guys. Absolutely delicious. And now I'll stop yapping my gums, and let's get into this interview with Steve Sims. Steve Sims, how you doing, man?
I'm doing well, thank you.
You got a nice little toy there behind you. That's a motorcycle.
I've got a few of them. I'm in my garage. I got I think there's like 9 here, but I got 12 bikes. I haven't got a car, so I'm basically spoiled with my little two-wheel friends.
That's awesome. Yeah, living out here in California really helps with the traffic, getting from place to place, especially where you are. You're out in LA, right?
Yeah, and I'm just out in the Malibu Mountains as well, so I've got all the canyon rides, so I'm not exactly spoiled for beautiful rides.
Oh, that's a beautiful, beautiful area. Absolutely. So let's get into this. You know, our audience might not know about you. They might know about you, but you're known as a high-end concierge, not necessarily for the rich and famous, but for the very wealthy and unknown, I think, as you put it one time, right?
Yeah, I deal with those people that walk down the high street. You have no idea who they are. They just happen to own the high street. That's my client.
And you've done like some really, really crazy things for them. Like just to put one example out there, and I think this is one of your more famous examples. You arranged a dinner at the feet of the Statue of David. And during you had Andrea Bocelli come out and serenade the couple.
Yeah, we closed down an entire museum in Florence. Didn't even tell the client who was coming in. I just literally told him it was a local singer. And then halfway through dinner, I had Andrea Bocelli walk in and start serenading them. So I tend to get a request from a client, listen to it, and then see how far I can take it. And that's what I've become pretty well known for.
And it's safe to say that, you know, they're probably not spending, you know, a couple hundred bucks doing that. They're probably spending significant amount of money, right?
Yeah, my clients are not the ones that will look at their bank account when they're getting invoice from me and see if they can spread over 3 credit cards. No, it's not the people I'm dealing with.
Absolutely. And, you know, I want to get a little bit more into that a little bit later on, but I kind of want to go back to the beginning, because I think what a lot of our audience is going to appreciate is that you started out with kind of a blue collar, gritty background, right?
I think I aspired to be blue collar and middle class. I think we aspired to be working class. We were that low. I was a bricklayer from East London with my family. That the first time I ever had takeout food was when I think I was 17. So we never went out for dinner. In fact, sorry, tell a lie. Our idea of going out was going down to the pub. We never went anywhere else other than the local pub. And that's what you just did in those days. That's what you did with that generation.
And how did you get from that to arranging, you know, these amazing, awesome, I guess you could say, dreams for the rich and very unknown?
Well, that was easy. I spent most of my life being pissed off. Like most entrepreneurs, we feel as though we don't fit. And as I was growing up on a building site with my dad and my granddad and my uncles and that, I'm looking at my entire family tree and I'm realizing that this isn't my life. I know it's not my life. And a lot of people will be happy to stay in that rut and then try and find something else. But it's like jumping into the swimming pool with just one leg. You physically can't do it. So what I used to do was I would try many different things and go, oh, maybe I should be a cake salesman. Maybe I should be a bouncer. Maybe I should be an insurance salesman. And then go, nope, freaking hate this. I'm out. And I was bouncing around. I was that lost cause that would have like 5 jobs within like an 8-month period on that resume. Until one day I talked my way into a stockbroking job in Hong Kong when I was still in London. They transferred me over there. I got drunk with them on the Saturday and the Sunday, went to orientation on the Monday, and I was fired on the Tuesday. So I think it's safe to say it was the shortest career that I ever had, 24 hours, which left me in Hong Kong.
How did you talk your way into a stockbroking job from
oh, that's, there? Yeah, so that's a whole thing. So there was, do you remember the bull and bear markets of America?
Yep.
Right, the bull market. So in Asia, they had something called the tiger market. That was where Asia was exploding. And Asia had an addiction to British stockbrokers, because let's not mince words, the British accent does very well in certain circles. It makes me sound smarter than I am, so game on for that one. And I actually was in London, and a friend of mine was a stockbroker, and he went, look, we're interviewing interns at the moment because we've got a whole bunch of the office going over to Hong Kong. So I turned up one day for a job wearing my dad's suit that fell off my shoulders. I looked like crap. And as I'm going down the hallway, on the right-hand side, there is a banqueting suite, one of the big halls in the bank, where they're talking about, you know, Hong Kong and all this kind of stuff. And they had a breakfast buffet in there that was amazing. First time I'd ever seen a breakfast buffet. First time ever. And as I'm walking down to where the interns were, there was coffee and I think bagels. And I just thought, more than likely, I'm not going to get a job as an intern here, but if I walk into that room, at least I'll get fed. So I actually walked back up, walked into that room as I owned it, started eating this buffet and challenging myself to how much I could eat. And then this girl was going around getting the names for people to make sure the welcome packet come. And I've got my face full of food. I gave her my name. Of course, she's looking through this sheet that she's got. This was the late 80s, you know, 89, 90. Yeah, 90. And she's going through the sheet. And of course, I'm not on it. And I went, look, let me make it easy for you. Steve Sims. And I gave her my name and address. And she went, thank you, I've got you. And then walked off. And then I put my foot down, my food down, because I thought I'm going to get caught any minute now. I put my food down and left. And it was about a week and a half later, I got my welcome package and my ticket to go to Hong Kong.
Holy crap. And what was your thought at that point? Were you like, how the hell did I do this? Or were you like,
well, my girlfriend, who thankfully is now my wife, she literally said to me, you know, what have you done? And I said, I just went in there for food. You know, I really didn't think it was going to be anything. I was working back on building sites now, trying to make some money. And, she's like, well, she said, are you going to be one of those people to get an opportunity and walk away from it, or are you going to grab it? And I was like, damn, you know, I can't not grab this opportunity. So I went for it. And of course, it failed abysmally. But I ended up working on the door of nightclubs in Hong Kong because, you know, let's be blunt, I'm big and ugly. And it worked for me. And then I noticed there were a lot of affluent people in Hong Kong. So I started being the guy that they came to get to know where's the parties, where it's happening, where it's not happening, what to avoid, how you can get certain things. I just became this guy that could sort things. And then the requests got bigger, the countries got more diversified. Before you know it, I'm flying from Hong Kong to Monaco to throw a bloody party during the Formula One, or shooting up the Stade to hang out at a polo party because the clients invited me. So I literally became the kind of the connector, the I don't know what you'd call it. I was the go-to guy to get shit done. And
you landed in Hong Kong, got fired, went, got a job as a bouncer.
Yep.
While you're a bouncer, you start get connected with all these people. Can you give some examples of, you know, how you started making those connections? What types of things
did you start doing at that? So probably there were a couple of turning points in my career that I can give you exact details on. There were these, let's be honest, if you want to make money, you need people that can afford you. So don't bother marketing to poor people. That's the first thing that I could never understand. So I always used to befriend people that were buying bottle services, people that were buying tables. If someone's coming in to nurse a beer for the night, I don't give a crap about that person. So these guys were coming in one night and there was a new nightclub that had opened up down the road. And I knew it was quiet inside. And as they started to walk in, I literally went, not tonight, guys. And they looked at me kind of like I'm mad. They were being turned away from a club that they regularly went into. And I said, boys, you're regulars. I recognize you. If you walk in there, you're going to be pissed off because it's quiet tonight because there's this new club that's just opened up down the road. So I'm going to do you a favor. Run down there, speak to Timmy on the door, tell him Sim sent you, have a good night. And they were like, oh, cheers. You know, I just turned them away from a club and sent them somewhere else. So, of course, they became regulars at asking me where to go, and I'd get little tips. And then one day they walked into, that was the first time that I suddenly started realizing that there was value in the relationship I had with people. And then they actually turned up at the club one night and they went, oh, you're going down to the harbor party? I didn't even know what party was going on. I was like, oh, which one you want about? You know, as though I knew about thousands of them. So they told me, and I went, well, why aren't you going? And they went, oh, we can't get in. We don't know who to ask. And that. So I went, all right. So they went into the club. I asked my fellow meathead just to guard the door for a second. I went down to the harbour, saw the girl out there. This is like, I don't know, 8 o'clock in the evening. Most clubs in Hong Kong are bars that then turn into clubbing later on. So you go early and stay. I walked down and I saw this girl. And I went, hey, how you doing? I suppose you're going to be busy tonight. And she's like, yes, I am. And I said, well, okay, great. My boys are coming down at, you know, the party, I believe, starts at 10 o'clock. So do you want them there at 9 or 9:30? What would you prefer to avoid the bottlenecks for you? And she was like, and she starts flicking through the paper, which made me giggle because I hadn't even given her my name. And I said, look, you know, again, I know you're going to be stressed. So do you want them here at 9 or 10 or when would you like them? So I never ask a question that someone can answer with a yes or a no. So she turns around and she's like, 10. Great. So I said, do you want me to give you the names again just to save you time? So I give her the names. And then I put my hand in my pocket and I said, look, quite simply, these guys are going to come along. They're going to go in. They're going to have a great time. But are they going to say thank you to you when they should? I hate to say it, but there are many people. Anyway, thank you in advance. I gave her $500. And I made $800 a night. So for $500, I was giving her most of my wages that night. And so I went back, walked into the club, and I said, hey, boys, I've just made a call for you, and you can go to that party tonight. And they were like, oh, that's fantastic. I said, yeah, have a good time. By the way, it's $500 each. So, you know, basically, I made $1,500 out of it. That was the first time I realized that the higher profile you got, the more perceptionally successful or perceptionally in power, and notice the word I'm saying is perceptionally, the least you will do that could possibly rock that perception. People don't want to either lean on who they are to get in, because then the favor's going to come back tenfold. They'd much rather phone me up and go, get it done. I get it done. I charge them 10 grand. And they walk through the front door like they were invited. That's what I discovered about the rich and unknown.
And just an important point there. I mean, you dealt with the gatekeeper with respect and you went up to her and you made sure that she was going to know exactly who you were and you made sure you got her attention.
Yeah. Now, let's be serious. The biggest pricks in the planet are middle management. Mm-hmm. Okay. Is those guys pretending they have more than they actually have. So I believe look after the lows, look after the highs. Forget the middles. Okay. They'll look after themselves. But they'll end up going into one of those areas. And you're right. It's the gatekeeper. You need to pay attention to them. Valet boys. You know, I will literally turn up at an event. I'll go, hey boys, have a good night. Oh, by the way, I've got some people turning up. Make sure that car's out of fun. Yeah. You give them $100 and the car turns up and they're like, leave it there, sir. You know, I'll sort out. You're a friend of Steve's? No problem. It makes everyone feel good. Okay. And so I always make sure of paying attention to the details. The rest of it just look after itself.
Now, from Hong Kong, so you said from that point, you were the bouncer, you were the guy everybody came up to get stuff done, and your reputation kind of traveled.
Yeah.
And that was just through word of mouth. How did you get the word out to others?
I didn't. I always believe my greatest marketing, and this actually does make me laugh, because you get a lot of people out there and they go, oh, no, I'm a referral business. All of my clients are, you know, friends of friends of friends. Bullshit. My company doesn't have an email address. It doesn't have a phone number. You literally have to know somebody that knows me to get anywhere near me. And that's how it works. And we're talking about this kicking off in the 90s, but we didn't even have bloody emails and websites. I didn't have a website until like 2004. And even the website now doesn't have a phone number or email on it, because I'm a great believer that if I tell you how absolutely incredible I am, that's marketing and branding. But if your best friend tells you how incredibly amazing I am, that's gospel. So I literally say to my clients, I only accept clients that are friends of friends, because I know you're not an arsehole, and I'm guessing you don't hang around with arseholes. So if your friend has a need, send him my way. And that's how it grew.
Now, let me ask you this, because you went from this blue collar background, and then you're working with extremely wealthy people, probably very, very demanding people. What type of work did you end up doing on yourself in order to get to that level? Or if any work, did you have to change anything? Did you have to change the way you dressed, the way you spoke, the way you carried yourself?
God, now you're getting nasty. So as an East London boy, I've always worn a black t-shirt, drank too much whiskey and rode around on motorcycles. And when I was in Hong Kong and Thailand, I moved out of Bangkok and then Geneva, I did the exact same. So I was always the guy in a black t-shirt, jeans, on a motorcycle. Funny enough, after about 7 years, so this is about 97, 98, actually it was 97, I even know the bloody date in June, I got nervous. I actually, after 7 years of doing what I was doing with some very famous people, some royal families, you know, big people. I was a big deal to about 2% of the planet. The rest of the world had no idea who I was, and that was fine. But I suddenly started getting nervous that I didn't look the right way. Now, I had ignored the fact that it had been successful for 7 years prior. I started taking out all my earrings and started wearing suits, and I did this crazy thing. I bought a car, okay? I actually bought a car, and I started turning up. I bought a Ferrari. And I turned up at my clients now in a suit, wearing a Ferrari. And do you know what I actually discovered? I started attracting the wrong kind of client. I started attracting clients that were impressed with me because I was wearing or driving impressionable things. And it was detracting from who I am. I turn up on a motorcycle and I'm sat next to you in a bar in a leather jacket going, all right, so you want to do this at the Vatican? You want to do this with Elton John? You want to do this with Elon Musk? All right, let's make it happen, you know? But no, I was now concerned about what I looked like. I spent so much effort on it. I was getting the wrong clients, getting depressed, and I actually went into a bender. I actually went into a massive slide. Lasted about a month, and then I sold the car. I had never sold the motorbike, but I sold the car, put the suits in the back of the wardrobe. I ended up throwing the suits away because they represented someone that I wasn't. But I remember getting a picture of myself at a Monaco party. And, you know, those were back in the days where you got the photograph sent to you in the mail. And I saw this picture and I realized I wasn't in it. This persona, this person that I was pretending to be was in it. And I was like, I don't like that guy. You know, I've already said in my life, I don't like to hang around with arseholes. Well, there's one, you know. And so it very much upset me. So I actually make a very, very strong point of staying true to me, warts and all. And I'm a great believer that we take a lot of effort to do what we do. In any business you've got, you put 100% effort and focus and work into that. I don't want any of that percentage to be taken up trying to be somebody I'm not. So I openly say it takes zero effort to be me.
That's important for our audience, because a lot of these guys, I mean, they're rolling around in black t-shirts. They're riding their own motorcycles, and a lot of them love whiskey as well. And I think that there's a lot of guys out there who just think that they can't do anything like what you're doing. And obviously I don't think anybody else in the world could do exactly what you're doing, but they think they can't rise to that level from where they are. What would you say to them about that?
Well, the first thing I would say is that's bollocks. I'm an East London biker, and I'm knocking around at the Vatican and Elton John in New York. So if I can do it, you're shit out of excuses. I am high on drive, low on IQ. If I need to do something, I'll find a way how to get it done. I'm a great believer that my I can is far in excess of my IQ. I would say quite openly, stay strong to who you are. In a world of insta-perfect pictures and lifestyles, we're actually searching for relatable people. And if you please understand, I am trying in every manner to avoid that shit mug word of authenticity. It's like saying, hey, I like you because you breathe. Of course you freaking breathe. I want authenticity to be something to be expected, not admired. I want it to be just something that, oh, this is who you are. I'm a great believer in transparency. When I knock on your door, when I phone you up, it's because I turn around and go, hey, how are you? I want something from you, but I've understood you need this. If we can agree that both of us are going to win in this situation, can we continue the conversation? I make it very clear that I'm going to be asking you for something, but I'm bringing something to the party every single time I do that. So keep your black T-shirts on. Stay true to yourself. No one did anything amazing by actually following others. So, you know, lead the crowd.
Awesome. You mentioned earlier in the interview that you never ask a question that can be answered with a yes or no. Why is that, and how do you do that?
So you walk up to Elton John and say, hey, Elton John, I'd like you to teach my client to play piano. How much is it going to cost? Okay. What's the high probability he's going to answer with that question?
He's going to say no right off the bat.
Straight off the bat. The richer you get, the less you want to be purchased. Right. Okay. So, you know, you're not buying a hooker. So the idea is that whenever you get people to do stuff for you, you have to have them to buy into your vision, your passion, and your purpose. So you will go up to someone, and if you go, hey, like you mentioned about the museum that I took over in Florence, okay? If I had walked up to the museum and said, can I rent the entire museum this Wednesday from 3 o'clock in the afternoon till midnight? The shortest word in the world, no matter what language you speak, is no. And the gut reaction is going to be no. So you contact them and you go, I want to talk to you about something I'm trying to put together and actually include you. It's going to be a phenomenal night. I'm just trying to work out what needs to happen in order for us to be able to do X, Y, Z. Now, they can't answer no or yes to that. Otherwise, they sound illiterate. You know, they have to go, well, we've never done that before. Fantastic. We're making history. So what are the next steps that I need to go through? And you enter them into conversations that they literally find that they can't answer with a yes and no. Now, I appreciate there's going to be a monetary aspect in this, and I got to tell you, that's not really a problem. But I do notice that you're also trying to raise money for your roof. So I'm sure actually doing something like this is going to help you. It's only at times like that that you want the affirmation for them to be able to go, yes, it will. That's fantastic. Now, let's get back to it. What steps need to happen in order for us to be able to get the meal done? So just always ask questions that they can't answer with a yes and no until it's a yes or no that you actually want.
That's interesting. So when you say, you know, you're coming up to somebody at the Academia in Florence, that was the name of the museum, right?
Yeah. Sorry, the Academia, yes.
Completely murdering that. the Academia in Florence. And you're going up to the person in charge and you say to them, you know, I want to set this couple up at the foot of the Statue of David. What specific thing would you say to somebody to convince them that that's a good idea?
Okay, so whenever you enter into a conversation with something that there is either a lot of money or a lot of control or a lot of permission required, mm-hmm. you don't walk in cold. There's no turkey shoot. So I found out that the Academia, and you're actually saying it right, the Academia was actually going to be throwing a gala later on in the year to raise money for roof renovations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I found that by simply doing this crazy thing called Googling it. and I found out about it. So as soon as I went along, I was able to say to him, the other thing is, and I learn all my information through quips and quotes. I always say that if I get a no, it's because I've asked the wrong person or the wrong question. Mm-hmm. So whenever I go into that environment, the first thing I do is to find out, and you can use that. You can use this technique. I won't actually make the first call. I won't actually have the first conversation. I will find someone in that arena that knows someone within what it is that I'm going to. If I can find two or three people to make an introduction, then by the time I actually speak to the people, they're turning around going, yeah, I've heard of you. Johnny said that you're a bit of a weird cat, but I should listen to you. Oh, yeah, Susie phoned me up about you. All right, how can I help? Do you remember I said to you earlier that if I tell you I'm brilliant, it's branding. If someone else tells you, it's gospel.
Right.
So that's what I do. I had someone, some very powerful clients I know in Florence, make the first phone call. So now that I'm making the phone call, I come in as a trusted, credible individual. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. No matter what it is I do, I search for people in my Rolodex that are in that same field, they're in that same gravity of the place or the person I want to get to. And I have them introduce me. And then what you do is you turn around and say, I've got this situation. But before we get into that, I'm aware that you're throwing a gala later on this year for a roof trust. Is that correct? Yeah, so you're trying to raise money for the roof. What are you trying to raise? Okay, I think I can help you with a substantial amount of that. So can I continue and let you know what I want? Who's going to say no? Now, I've used the, hey, I believe your kids go to this school. How would it be if I actually supplied a computer for every class? How would it if I actually donated to the new roof that's going on there, or the new building, or the new annex, or the new AstroTurf? So you go in showing value. I've done that with Journey. I've done it with Elton John. I've done it with Bocelli. I've done it with the Vatican. I've done it. Anytime I go into any relationship, I go in doing my homework and saying, I am aware that you are launching a book, going on tour, releasing a movie. I've got a way I can help you. May I continue and let you know what it is I require? So you're going in with value, but also complete and utter transparency that I want something out of it. I'm not funny. I'm going, oh, I can help you with this. Because if I do that, you're now suspicious. What's in it for you? I'm going to tell you what's in it for me. I need you to allow me to be in that museum 3 o'clock till midnight.
So you're always leading with reward and then quickly making it known that you're going to make the ask right there.
Absolutely. Very crystal clear. That's the first 5 seconds of the conversation. I've therefore shown them that I've done my research. I've therefore shown them that I'm not there to spin wheels. I've made it crystal clear to them that I want something. They may not know what it is by that time, but they've also crystal clear that I've done my homework, that they are in need, and I have a way of making it work out for them.
Wow. Now, a lot of people, that's extremely, extremely simple, right? A lot of people, that they'll sit back and they'll say, okay, it sounds like it's easy for him, but they're not going to try to apply this in their own lives. And I see that over and over again. A lot of people, they'll run into a gem of wisdom, and then all of a sudden they'll sit there and they'll say, that sounds too easy.
Do you know, here's the dumb shit thing with that, is that you've read the book. Have you read the book? I don't want to put you on the spot.
Absolutely.
You've read it? Okay.
One of the best books I've read this year.
All right. Okay. Was any element of it rocket science?
None. It was
absolutely none. But here's the dumb thing. If I told you I have a way that you can actually take over a museum, but it's going to cost you $2,000 for this CRM program and $1,000 per month revenue share, it's going, here's the shit. You'd buy it because you'd think, oh, that's what I got. People ignore the simple, simplistic ways. If I yell at you in the street for half an hour, you're going to realize I don't like you. And you're going to realize we've got a problem. Correct?
Right. Absolutely.
All right. Now, this isn't extreme. But if I punch you in the head the first 3 seconds I meet you, I've just translated the exact same amount of information. You're now fully aware that I don't like you and we have a problem. Now, we're not going to do that. I'm not going to meet you in the street and punch you in the head. But my point is that everything I do is the shortest route possible with the clearest message possible with the least possibility for you to misunderstand what it is I'm after.
Absolutely.
It's impactful, it's energy efficient, and it's transparent. And quite simply, here's the last big E, it's freaking effective.
Absolutely. You know, and I have to say, I read your book about 6 months ago. I'd heard you on a podcast and I was like, I gotta read this. And after reading it, honestly, it had a huge impact on my ability to get guests for the podcast. I was able to get some pretty high-end guests, and it all came from those two things, just leading with reward, telling them exactly what was in it for them, and then making the ask.
It's the simple stuff. I've tried telling everyone, and I do this with my clients, and I do it on my website, and I do it through my emails with the Steve stuff. I try to teach people the most effective, easiest route for you to be able to get what you want.
Definitely. Now, let me ask you this. What was what are some of the weirder things you've been asked, or some of the most extraordinary things you've been asked to do?
You actually went kind of awkward there on the tone. Can you hear me again now, by the way?
Yeah, I can hear you. You froze up for all right. Just a second.
Okay. I try not to look at it as weird and crazy, because if I did that, I think most of the stuff that I do, I would probably call weird and crazy. But every time anyone asks me that question, I always remember one guy in Palm Beach that contacted me. He wanted to pay a lot of money, and the only thing he wanted to do was detonate a nuclear warhead. And I said to him, why? And he said, I just want to be responsible for detonating the most powerful thing in the world. Now, this was back in early 2000. Had it been now, I may have reported him to the police. But at the time, he just wanted to push the button. And I said to him, I'm not in business to do any harm or any of that kind of stuff. So I've done some fun and freaky stuff, but I draw the line and embarrassing anyone, hurting anyone, and really just sticking you on a pedestal, I don't do any of that.
Yeah, I imagine having somebody ask you to blow up a nuclear weapon would be interesting. But you have gotten people to train with the Navy SEALs, right?
Yeah, train with them, shoot with them, jump out of helicopters with them, using the Navy SEALs as an example. We've done a lot of stuff with those guys and with the military up in the Pentagon. We were in the White House a couple of weeks ago. So, yeah, we've had some fun and frolics.
Absolutely. And I've heard a story that you almost got a selfie with the Pope.
Yes. I had been doing some work in the Vatican. And for about 3 days running, three visits running over a period of maybe about a month, I'd been hoping to meet him. And every time I'd been invited in there, I'd wear a suit. And then this one day I turned up because I was just checking something backstage in the Vatican. And I turned up in a black T-shirt and jeans. And that was the one time he turns up. And because we were in a very secure private area, I pulled out my phone to get a selfie and basically got accosted by all of the Swiss guards, being told that we weren't allowed to take a selfie in that room. So I didn't get it. So I'll have to go back and see if he's open for a second try.
Now, back to your book. You know, like I said, it's one of the best books I've read this year. It is extremely simple, right? It is very, very simple, very, very in your face stuff. But it also, I mean, it makes a lot of sense and you know, makes a lot of common sense.
Good.
When did you decide to write a book and why did you decide to do a book?
So I'd always been asked to do a book on the rich and famous and the rich and unknown in what I did. And I'd always refused it because if I named any of my clients, I could be dead by cocktail hour. I had started doing a lot of speeches and I do a lot of speaking events, and I'd started doing a lot of speaking events to entrepreneurial groups and mastermind and sales training, these kind of things. And I've been approached this time by Simon Schuster, who said, we don't want you to do a book naming names. We'd like you to do a book not on what you do, but how you do it. And I've got kids, and I very much hate the way everyone tries to overcomplicate things. Everyone lives in an insta-perfect life. The art of true relationships is dying. But that's sad, because all of my power, all of my strength, all of my money comes from my ability to be able to make a text, a phone call, or send a video to someone to get what I need. So I think relationships have the greatest ROI out there. This was a chance for me to put a book together and actually shout as to what I wanted and get people to change to make a world more of what I wanted to live in. So I used it as my pedestal to be able to get on stage and go, look, you think you're communicating through Snapchat, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and you are, but badly. And this is why. And I'm using it now as a platform to be able to do that, to teach people the art of real communication and the value in it. Because it's still, I could ask you to build a bridge, okay? How many years did you study as an engineer?
I wasn't an engineer. I was in the Marine Corps, but I was right. For 6 years, yeah.
Okay, but you've never done any engineering?
Nope, never done any of that.
Right. I guarantee you within half an hour, you could probably download an app or on a program that will be able to give you the blueprints to build a bridge, correct?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. You try and find an app or a blueprint that can teach you how to communicate. It doesn't exist. It'll teach us how to speak in French, but it won't teach us what to say. And I believe it's still the final bastion of communication, the final bastion of us, that we're losing the ability to actually truly communicate with people.
Wow. Yeah. And, you know, I don't know. I'm noticing that more and more with social media in general. Not only is communication going down, it's also becoming a little bit more nasty. You know, people will say things to people over social media that they would never say to them in person.
Well, no, because again, if I'm in a bar with you, and I'm not going to talk about punching you in the head again, but if I'm in a bar with you and you say a joke that offends me, okay, you're going to see a change without saying anything. You will pick up on a vibe that rubbed me the wrong way. You will pick up on my body language that I'm closing down to want to talk to you. You'll pick up on all those things and you'll be like, Sims, you know, well, bloody hell's wrong with you? And I'll be like, well, you know, your joke was about three-legged people. My mum had three legs and that kind of thing. You'll be like, oh, sorry, man. Yeah. It does that. We react off of each other. Mm-hmm. The problem is we're losing that reactivity. So you go onto Twitter, you post something on Twitter, the person doesn't respond within the first hour, you're pissed off, it gets buried under loads of stuff, you then meet the person. I had this last week. I was speaking at Cole and Sonia Hadder's Thrive event in Vegas. This pilchard came up to me and stood in front of me and went, I sent you a DM accusing me. And I said to him, fucking how am I supposed to do with a DM? You know, why didn't you phone me? I don't have your phone number. Well, there you go. Problem solved, you know? So it's these people that think that they're actually communicating by sending someone an instant message or tweet or something like that. But they're not. They're not communicating just because you can send a message to anyone in the planet now. And let's be blunt. The more successful you are and the more profile you do. And there's times when I'll go away and I'll have a couple of people just looking over my social media just to make sure that if there's any question that's answered, they're not getting me, you know? So if someone's like, oh, Steve, I need to talk to you about so-and-so, it may not get through to me. You know, if you want to get through to me, send me an email or phone me up. And I know you're going to say, well, how do we get your phone number and your email? Well, that's not my problem.
Well, that brings up another point too. It's almost really important to keep your circle small, but the circle you have to fill it with really good, decent people who are going to lift you up.
Oh, jeepers. I don't know if you've, and I'm not pitching this now. I know we spoke earlier about it, but do you get my emails?
No, I don't get your emails right now.
Right. Okay. So here's something for you and your audience. And you did line it up. We need to confirm that we never spoke about lining this up though. Yeah. So I have the website, stevedsims.com, or as I was speaking to you earlier, For anyone in the US, you can text the word ugly works, or one word, ugly works, to 345-345. Now, this is why this is so important to mention that now. When you do that, you will actually get my newsletter and a video. And the video is called The Chug Test. Mm. Now, do you remember I said to you that in when I was got the photographs back, that I wasn't the person I thought I was, and I went into a bender? Right. Do you remember that?
Yep.
Earlier on in this podcast? It was actually a really bad time in my life. It was when I probably was at my lowest, and I drunk myself stupid for a few days in a row. Closed the door, locked the office, didn't come out, peed in a gas can, in a trash can, didn't want to leave. I was in a real downward spiral. Now, when I came out, you would have thought I'd have been put off of whiskey for the rest of my life. But I decided that if I couldn't drink whiskey with someone, I didn't want them in my circle. You know, because someone's got to be okay with me for me to be okay with them. So we came up with this little crazy thing called a chug test, where, and I'll go through the test with you now. For all of those that, you know, don't want to text or subscribe, that's fine. I'll give you the ins and outs of it. So if you're walking up the high street and you're on the left-hand side of the road, and on the right-hand side of the road, someone walking the other side is someone in your business, a partner, a girlfriend, a boyfriend, someone in your family, an accountant, a print press guy, whatever, someone in your world. Do you quickly look in the left and pretend you're actually interested in those porcelain ducks? Or do you run across the road, jump in front of them and go, Jimmy, let's go grab a beer, a whiskey, a coffee. Come on, man. Which one of those do you do? If you turn around and you're looking in that store, checking the reflection until they walk past, turn it back around and then walking off, get that person out of your life, okay? Because you don't want them to be there. You've just acknowledged you don't want them to be there. They shouldn't be there. If you get rid of the bad people in your life, it'll make space and way for the good people in your life. And that's where you become more relaxed. I am probably one of the wealthiest men you will ever meet. And I'm wealthy because I'm comfortable. I'm confident in the people I have around me. I love and laugh on a regular basis. And I can phone up a million people and say, let's have a whiskey tomorrow night, and it'll happen, and we can just tell bad jokes to each other for the entire night. For me, that's wealth. It's got bugger all to do with money. It's got everything to do with your state of mind.
That's really important, because, you know, a lot of guys I see, they associate wealth with just money and material things and more toys and you know, whatever other thing you'd spend your money on that's going to rot or rust or depreciate. But a lot of times you forget when you're starting something and you're starting on your road that it's relationships that matter. The people you're around matter. And if you find yourself with all the money in the world surrounded by people that make you miserable, you're going to be frigging kicking yourself in the knees.
Yep. It's a tough one. It is a tough one. And I don't want anyone out there thinking I'm full of crap, you know, and I'm sitting in the garage full of nice toys. But they don't have anything to do with my wealth. And if a friend of mine phoned up and said, I need 30 grand or I need 20 grand real fast, can I have your motorbike to sell? Fine. You know, pull up, get rid of it. Fine. Pay me back when you can. So no, it's got to be important to focus on how you live your life and not with what.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that's, really what I get from you and just talking to you and hearing you talk in other places and reading your book is that you have a deep love for people, like in general, like you have a deep love for people and being able to help people. And, you know, that's a big reason why you're spreading your message. Now you're starting to do these speakeasies. Tell us about those.
So I get to speak at a lot of very large events. As I say, the one in Vegas last week, I think it was like 2,000 people. I was in one a couple of weeks before that. I'm in one in San Diego in a couple of weeks' time. So I'm used to speaking in front of these big crowds. But I actually run these speakeasies. And the definition of a speakeasy is you don't know where it's going to be. You need to get the password. You need to turn up at a certain time. And so I don't announce the people that are going to be in it. It's 30 people maximum. I've got one coming up in New York in November. And it's usually like a two-day event where we get together. I bring some of my friends in to be able to teach you different things. And these are people that, let's be completely blunt and, you know, borderline arrogant, that normally you wouldn't even be able to sit in a room with. Yeah, they're coming in to help you. And they're going to go, look, this is how I do stuff. And you're going to be able to ask them questions. It's a time when we can grow as a community. And at the end of it, I usually throw an experience, which again, normally wouldn't be one that you would be able to get to. I'm doing these in Silicon Valley, Miami, New York, LA, probably going to go international soon, but they're just small groups of people that want to grow, love, and build a community, do the best they can. Because I've spent years spending rich people's money on giving them great cocktail stories. I'm now using what I've learned to be able to put you in a position so that you can make your own cocktail stories.
That's awesome. And you have a course as well, don't you?
I do. We've got a few things. You know, you can go to stevedsims.com and see that. It's only one M in Sims. You know, I've got a course. It's something like about $297. I've also got two other things. You can actually book me for a phone call where for quite simply 30 minutes, I'll answer anything you need and hopefully solve some issues. We've had quite a few clients do that. We've been able to solve an issue within that 30 minutes that they've not needed to do anything further. We actually have a community called The Pub, and The Pub is a community of people. So that not only do you get me, you get my Voxer, you get webinars, you get online teaching and practice. You also get the community as well, and you're the first to hear about the speakeasies. So I have those three things. I have the course, the phone call, and The Pub.
Awesome. I know we got to wrap up here in a second, but I have one more question, and it relates to something you said earlier in the interview. You talked about the fact that your wife was with you back before all this stuff happened, right? Before she's with you back when you were a bricklayer in East London. And
yep.
My question for you is, through this all, right, through all these transitions that you made, through all the growth, what was your secret to really keeping it together?
Transparency. I think there's an underlying theme there. And when the shit's hitting the fan, see, here's the daft thing. And I did this, you know, I'm not going to say my relationship's been sparkly and brilliant all the time. It hasn't. It is now. It has been for many, many, many years. But like anyone, we went through our rocky period to be able to learn each other's rhythm. When you have a bad day at work, the normal thing that you would do is come home, eat dinner with the family, but not actually talk about it, not be open about it. Why? Because you were trying to protect them from tough things going on. Well, you're not protecting them because now they're sitting there going, well, why is he in a pissy mood? Have I done something to offend him? And all of a sudden, there's this friction in the rub. So we learned very many years ago, if I'm having a bad mood, I'll come over to my wife and I'm like, I'm having a bad mood. I can't get this. I don't have enough money for this. This has happened. Everything's going wrong in that area there. And she will know exactly what's wrong, but more importantly, know that it has no relevance to her. So I'm a great believer in the transparency so that she can get an idea of what I'm going through. The amount of times I've gone, oh, this and this and this and this, and she's gone, well, why don't you just do that? And sometimes you're too much in the picture to be able to look at the picture. And it takes an outsider to be able to look and go, well, you're not connecting the dots. And you go, oh my God, I don't have a problem now. So transparency is key.
Yeah, I think that's a huge part of your story as far as everything goes that I hadn't heard before. You know, as far as I think that's a huge part of being successful is being able to keep a relationship like that together and to have somebody in your life who's supporting you through that, who's helping you through that. And I think it's a problem for a lot of guys because they get themselves wrapped up into relationships where the communication is poor. And where they don't feel like they can be transparent. And I can't think of anything worse or that can hold the person back more than getting involved in a romantic relationship with somebody who can't do that for you.
Well, you've just said can't do it for you, yet you've turned around and you've said about communication. The chances are that if you've got a bad relationship, and I hate to say this, fellas and ladies, but 80% of it is probably going to be your fault. So if you're not willing to be transparent, if you're not willing to be open, it's your fault. It's your fault. So you've got to find a situation where you can be as open as possible. Now, if the other person doesn't reciprocate, then that's a relationship that needs to find the door, because it's not there for you. But you're not going to know that until you open up. Luckily, I opened up and I found that there was a relationship that was way stronger. I love my wife way more now than I ever did when I met her. Jeepers, you know, it's not even close. You've got to find that relationship that basically makes you twice as big.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Steve, number one, I want to thank you so much for coming on today. Number two, like I said, I want everybody to go out there and check out your book, Blue Fishing. Lots and lots of good information in here. And, you know, like I said, it's one of the best books I've read this year. It's helped me so much in managing this podcast and getting guests on. And then beyond that, you know, everybody should be checking out your website, stevedsims.com. And, you know, any last words to the audience, Steve?
No, just stop overcomplicating shit and just do it. You know, get going and then get good.
Absolutely. Ladies and gents, thank you so much for listening to the Warrior Soul podcast this week. And like the man said, get out there and get to it and get out there and live your best lives while you can.